Welcome in. I'm Doug Gottlieb, and this is All Ball. All Ball. And we have we had a great pod series. We have unbelievable pods lined up that you are going to love. Make sure you tell all your friends about this. David Fizdale will be my guest, the former Grizzlies and Knicks head coach. His journey, what went wrong in Memphis, what it was like to work with LeBron, what it was like during the ISO Joe era, what happened with Eric Musselman when he got back into the NBA with the Golden State Warriors. There's so much stuff there. So much stuff. You're going to love this pod. You know, I haven't done a pod since the national championship game. And you're like, well, that's kind of weird. No, we had some in the can, and I mean, we did a lot, and I was a little crushed work-wise, and I wanted to kind of let it simmer. And I have a lot of things to comment on, including the Tommy Lloyd hire, which I don't love considering the timing. And it has nothing to do with Tommy. Like, I like Tommy. Who doesn't like Tommy? He's a good guy. And I'm all for assistant coaches getting opportunities instead of the classic retread. But that's not a retread job. I felt like Damon Stoudemire and Miles Simon had equal or better experience, and they're part of the basketball family, and that's supposed to be, quote, a player's program. That's what they call themselves, a player's program, and then you just shun the players in that program because a booster wanted Tommy Lloyd. That feels like a hard setup for Tommy and a bad deal for Damon and for Miles. That said, we haven't talked since the national championship game. Everyone knows my infatuation with this Gonzaga team, and I got to tell you, I missed it, and my coaching buddies, especially in the Big 12, had it right, and I had it wrong. They all said, like, look, Baylor is as good or better at most positions. They're crazy athletic, and while they might not be Gonzaga offensively at times, they're so much better defensively. And we're dropping this pod the day after Chet Holmgren, the number one prospect in America, commits to play for the Zags. Probably have Drew Timmy back. We'll see what else they have around them. And look, Chet Holmgren can defend the rim. And he'll be more than he's 195 now, probably 215 by the time we get to this time next year. That's reasonable, 20 pounds in a year, considering he turns 19 years old here May 1st. So with that in mind, they'll be right there to be a favorite to get there. And the difference is, this is the big thing with Gonzaga and how I missed and what I said about them forever up until this year. This year, I was so taken by how they played, how connected they were, the athleticism of their backcourt with Jai and with Jalen Suggs, that I missed it. Gonzaga has never been to a place where they can change how you play based upon their defense. They can't take you out of what you want to do. Baylor could. Villanova could. North Carolina, when they won their national championship with Roy Williams, kind of similar to Gonzaga, that's always, but they have found a way with traps, and they're a little bit more athletic across the board. You know, you go back, and they've always had a couple better defenders who were really, really good college players, maybe overdrafted because of it. I just look at it, and where I missed was Gonzaga couldn't take you out of what you want to do. Baylor could. Baylor was better. Do I think that the UCLA game and their dead legs played a part? Absolutely. But I would also tell you that Baylor was just so much more athletic, and Gonzaga had such a struggle, and Drew Timmy, who was able to wheel and deal around everybody in college basketball, couldn't around their bigs. Couldn't. And then they all had to guard at the other end. Baylor was the better team. Would it have been a better, more competitive game if Jalen Suggs hadn't gotten foul trouble early? Yes. Would it have been a better, more competitive game if if Gonzaga hadn't been played such an incredible game late at night on Saturday night to UCLA? Yes. Would Baylor still have been better? I think so. I got more thoughts on hires and fires upcoming. But without further ado, I wanted you to hear this because we're getting ready for the NBA playoffs. And here's a guy who coached in college. He coached in the pros. He played in college. We grew up we weren't close friends. We didn't play, but we played against each other some. He's a little bit of 1 year and a half, 2 years older than me. Here's part one of my sit down with former Knicks and Grizzlies head coach and David Fizdale.
So Fiz, let's start at the beginning. Like, when you first started hooping, you're a kid, where was it?
I would say, obviously, L.A., South Central was probably the hugest part of my basketball influence. And it's funny, I was just talking to your guy off air, and I think about just that whole time of growing up in L.A. and the basketball of that time, and I think about all of us, you know, because, yeah, we lived in a different part of L.A., and that's fine, but we always was in the gym together. You, myself, Jock Vaughn, all of us kids always were in the gym together, hooping, competing against each other and sharpening each other's swords. So I look back at you know, obviously L.A. and you know, learning from you guys, really.
Was it challenge? Did you ever do Challengers Boys Club? Did you do Victoria Park? Like, I remember Victoria Park was like, for me, that was –
huh? Yeah, Slam and Jam, Izzy. That was our deal. Like, we would go to Carson to play with Tyus and them, and Joe Roseboro and all. Remember those guys? All of those guys, right? And so, I mean, I just remember being a young kid doing that. It started for me on the west side, though, of L.A. At Robertson Park, where my junior high coach, then elementary school, Al Birdsong, really, I don't know if people realize it, but was creating his own little like talent code at Robertson Park in LA. And when I say that, because now looking back on it and understanding what that means, is I came out of that park where you had Cedric Sabalas, you had Chris Mills, you had Tina Thompson, you had many time people that obviously played high level college basketball that may not have played in the league, but I'm missing Nick Smith. Good God, I'm really drawing a blank right now. But like, basically, at the end of the day, it's probably
LaRon Ellis was that time as well. I'm trying to think who else was.
I mean, there's so many guys, so many gals. Cynthia Cooper came through there. It was just so many people that was just in that little gym, competing and playing and going at it. And Sean Higgins, Kevin Ollie. You know, I can keep going. Like, all in this one little gym, and so. Here I am, a little kid, you know, Tina Thompson and myself, you know, constantly getting thrown into the fire, fighting for every second we get to get on the court, which, you know, is tough when back in the day when that was the fun part about pickup. I think a lot of these kids miss out on was what you had to go through, one, to get on the court and be respected as a person that can help a team win, you know, but two, to consistently be picked by an adult. And then all of a sudden now you're a staple at the park, and now you're starting to be able to pick teams, and like that transition of understanding your role at the park and understanding situations. Like, if I got a average to below average shot as a kid, I wasn't taking that to win the game, because I knew most likely if I missed, I'd never get picked again. Right. And so you start to learn your role really quick.
Well, plus if you lose, you sit. Right?
You sit like, forever. You might as well go to 7-Eleven.
Yes. Yeah. So I grew up in Orange County.
Yeah.
And my dad was, you know, he's like a New Yorker. So he thought like the way to play basketball is to go to a park, get in a game and stay on the court, whatever. So he started taking me to Miles Square Parks in Fountain Valley.
I remember.
And the first wave was like at 7 a.m. So we get there like 6:45, whatever. You're like shooting. And they like take the first 10. I'd never get taken. Then dudes start calling games and you're like four games back and there's 14 guys there. Right? You're like, whoa, wait. 14 guys here. You know, because dudes wait for whoever the four best guys who lose.
Who's the best players? Who's the best player?
Or they get somebody that comes up out of their car. They roll up right before the game, you know. So you wait and you wait and wait and you finally get on. And then my dad would make sure, like, I would get the game. And then he'd stay and watch the first game. If I win, you know, then he'd just take off and be like, all right, you're good. Here's $5. I'll come back later.
Right.
But it was the same thing. So, like, catty corner across the street, you could go and get a Gatorade. And maybe a piece of pizza or something. And he'd give me like $5 and, you know, he'd call collect, but hang up when you need to get picked up. Right. Hey, I'm done. That was my, so that's like my, so, okay. Then your first like organized travel team was who?
The B&B Spurs.
Oh yeah.
absolute staple on the West Side, Mike Morrison and George Steele, and then my coach Al Birdsong. That's where we all ended up moving from Robertson to Queen Anne Park, which was up on off of Pico in Mid City, closer to where Walt Hazard and his kids live. You know, two.
So Khalil,
yeah,
and Tutu and Rashid.
Yep. All of them play for the Spurs.
Right, but they went and came. They played for us too.
Yep. Yes, absolutely. So when I was,
Think about that for a second, right? Like,
yeah.
And there was the amazing thing about that family. if you think back, and it's hard for somebody to conceptualize it now, but here's a guy who was the point guard for John Wooden's first national championship team. He was the head coach of UCLA at the time, right? And like, we used to go and hang out at their house. I think it was in the Fairfax district, right?
Yeah.
And it was like nothing, like no big deal.
We'd be running around the house like it was like he was just a regular old guy.
Regular guy.
Said, you know, it's crazy because I really stayed in contact with them. You know, Doc is a big time music producer now. Obviously Grammy winner. He's won Grammys with Eminem. It's amazing. Yes. You know, and then obviously Toots has coached in the NBA and is doing development stuff. He's coaching in the G League now. And so I've stayed really close to them, man. And it was just a normal thing. You know, we'd be over there just messing around. And we was in the house of a Hall of Fame, you know, groundbreaking, you know, guy. It was the fact that he was an African-American man who had done all of this too during those times. That was not something to just bat an eye at when you look at
honestly, and I mean this in all sincerity, I have a hard time understanding a lot of it because it was just never a thing
with us,
right?
Yeah,
it was never a thing. Like nobody, I mean, obviously I knew I was white and I knew they were black, like, and I understood culture was like different, but there was no, it just, I part of it is, and LA has always been homogenous, you know, like in many ways, especially in basketball. But it's weird. Like that is, we're talking about 35 years ago. And like we have, it feels like it's worse. I don't know. It feels like it's worse now.
It is. It is, Doug, because we're not neighborly like that no more. It was now that our tribes are pulling us apart again. And then, you know, we didn't, like you said, it wasn't about, at least in our little basketball world, it was just about, do you like to hoop or not?
Yeah.
Are you a hooper? Do you care about hooping? You know, your dad and Izzy Washington and Rich Goldberg and all of these people, they were just about basketball.
Yes.
And so they provided us a platform, one that got us out of situations where we would have probably shouldn't have been.
Sure.
But two, it gave us an opportunity to really like express ourselves in a positive way and really see, like you said, without knowing it, we were learning lessons of tolerance and equity and looking at people, seeing ourselves in people at an age and didn't understand it, but we were seeing that early on. And that's why it's so easy to spot the other now, because we had such an incredible environment of diversity. Cameron Sufi is one of the best guards I've ever played against in my life. Doesn't look like me, doesn't look like you, but is a baller. And he was ours, right?
How about this one? So Cameron, like he grew up in Fountain Valley.
Yeah.
And we met him. I was playing at Miles Square Park. And like he was a little bit older than me, maybe a year older than me.
Yep.
And he couldn't get on the court, whatever. My dad like helped him get on the court. We'd play together. We'd pick up like three old men, whatever. And then he became like a teammate. And I'll never forget like the first time I went to his house for dinner.
Yeah.
We sat on the floor and I was like, it was so cool. It was so cool. And then just became normal, right?
He's your family member.
Now it seems like a bigger thing than it was then.
I just think people have gone into their tribes. I think information, the way it's being skewed now, there's so many things that divide us that easily can divide us. And I just think back then it was a simpler time. And it was, I think people at that point too, was kind of taking the exhale from all of the race stuff and all of that. You know, there was an opening for consciousness during that stretch. I really feel that. And obviously there's been a resurgence of the other stuff, but you know, we just didn't, it really wasn't in our face like that. It was in our face in the hood from the standpoint of how we were policed.
Yeah.
You know, but even that, I didn't even look at it as racism. I just looked at it as just straight, just brutality. You know,
it was like more of a power trip. I thought it always felt like a power trip.
Yeah, right? I always saw as a kid, I saw it as that. So, you know, that's why I will never. You know, we just had such a we're just so lucky and so blessed to have grown up in such a wonderful pocket of time. In California, in Southern California, but with basketball, you know.
It's interesting. It's interesting you say that, because you were talking about Izzy, my dad, Rich Goldberg, and those guys. And I'm sure, you know, like, I don't know. I don't know what Izzy's, that was his job. Like, my dad, he had his own like business after he got, you know, they got fired in Long Beach State. But, you know, there's a bunch of different things that have happened that have changed it. And now having my own little program, it's like, you know, I think the biggest thing is people have decided they can make money doing it. Right. And so are you about the kid, you know, like you're carrying like 12 on a team, right? Are you carrying 12 on a team because you're trying to help the kids? You're carrying 12 on a team because that's the way you make more money.
You know, right? What the status was back in the day for your pops and them? Did my kid get a scholarship?
Yes.
That was the deal. What's my kid's ranking on Don Meade's scouting service?
Yes. Don Meade. My dad was so mad when Don Meade had me as a mid-major going into my junior summer.
Poked in your
gut. That Don Meade, he can't evaluate. I was like, I didn't care. Like, wait, mid-major? Like, I'm going to get a college scholarship? Like, that's cool. He's like, yeah, I'm mid-major. I can play Western Kentucky. You know, like, I remember, like, Western Kentucky just sent me this long note. I was like, ugh.
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com. And within the iHeartRadio app, search FSR to listen live.
B&B Spurs were nice. So give me some dudes who are on that squad.
So on my team, it was Ty Whitehead.
Yes. We stole him at some point. Play with us.
Yeah, Ty ended up going to the Candy Bulls and to you guys out there.
Yes. And by the way, Tiny still working dudes out the Caney Bulls. I'm gonna have him come down and work my kids out this week. Tiny's great.
Tiny is awesome. But on my exact team was Alexis Scruggs.
Yes.
Kevin Ollie.
Yes.
Chris Ford.
You got you and Kevin Ollie in the same backcourt?
I didn't start. What are you
of
talking?
Of course not.
My eighth grade. I couldn't start on that team because you had Chris Ford, who was the L.A. City Player of the Year for 2 years at Fremont, who I played with later,
yes,
and Kevin Ollie. And that was the backcourt. We had a guy named Lavelle Hall.
Sure.
Who was a big old guard. And so in the eighth grade, I had to wait to get my turn in the ninth grade to start and play. But I played a lot, but it wasn't like – but those are the guys. That was the group of guys. I had a kid named Chris Kaufman, who was really good on the team. Who am I forget? Joey Drake, who played at Crenshaw. A kid named Achebe, who was really good. God, we had a good team. It was us and the rival in the city was us and K&E. So K&E had Dwayne Bradbury. They had Manu, Kevin Beal, all the dudes that went to Manual.
Yes.
They had Todd, who was one of their best players. Robert Moore, who was the guy that kept me on the bench at Fremont, the point guard that kept me on the bench at Fremont. I mean, they were really good.
See, but what would have happened now was you would have gone and switched teams. Yeah. And then if you went to Fremont and you didn't play, you would have gone and switched schools. Now, look, in fairness, like, I played for my pops, so I probably played a little bit before I should have. But
you could hoop like
I appreciate it. But it's like I told my son is, you know, he just turned 12 and we're gonna have to hold him back because he's so little. And anyway, he was like, well, in sixth grade, you won a national championship. I was like, hold up. I got picked up to run with Rich Goldberg squad because we had this Samoan dude, Lorenzo Liloa, who's like 6 feet, had a mustache. And they took me. I was like, I barely played, dude. Cameron Murray was a better player. Alex Lopez, Brooke and Robin's brother, was 6'6". He was better, dude, right? Like,
people don't know about him, but they got an older brother who's our age. That's a baller.
So, like, he's like, you want to ask Jim? I was like, hey, I barely played. Like, I went. I had a good time.
Yeah.
But I barely played. Like, I wasn't that good. And whatever. Then on my dad's AU team, I was the backup point guard. We had Jimmy Harris, who went to LMU. And
he drove me crazy at LMU. I played against him for three years at USD.
All right, so you go to Fremont.
Yeah.
Okay. Who's the coach of Fremont?
Sam Sullivan, who was my second cousin. It's the only reason I went because everybody was going to Crenshaw. And a few of the guys from the Spurs, Chris Ford had went, and a kid named Curtis Presley, who I played with, went to Fremont. And it turns out, you know, I didn't remember it, but I realized, oh God, my cousin is the coach there. And he and Keith Young came to visit my mom because my mom, we were on the west side of LA. You know, Fremont is all the way right on the border of Compton and Watts and all of that stuff. So my cousin came over there and was like, look, if you let me take him, I'll take good care of him. I'm not going to give him any free passes. I'm going to keep my foot up his butt, but I'll keep an eye on him. And so that made my mom feel good. So I ended up going to school on the other side of town in Fremont.
What was she like in terms of, like, you obviously were a hooper, you loved it. What was she like with you through this
discipline.
Time?
She was very, she allowed me to really go after it. She never got in the way of that. Because the good part was my older brother had gotten a scholarship to play football at the University of Hawaii. And so he was a great kind of, he like paved the road for me, you know, from that regard. So it wasn't a hard track with my mom from a sports standpoint when she saw what sports can end up doing for someone and the life that it can provide. But what she always tried to stay on me about was, you know, knowing who I was while doing this thing. She used to just always say, it's not who you are, it's something you do. She just used to always remind me of that. And I didn't realize it until now, after a whole lot of suffering, losing two jobs and, you know, a lot of ups too. But when you suffer, you really start to dive into yourself. And the lesson she was trying to teach me about the ultimate goal of really understanding who you are, it's really played out now as a father, as a husband, as a, you know, a guy who coached and has won and lost. So, you know, she was amazing in from that regard. And you know, in that environment, you know, and that's in my neighborhood in LA, it was really violent, really violent. You know, Tina Thompson and I lived in the same apartment building. And in our neighborhood, crack had hit, and it was the Wild West. Drive-bys every other day, fights all the time, you know, crackheads everywhere. You know, the show Snowfall is a great example of what LA was like, you know, in that time. And so for her to, I don't know, navigate that, working two jobs, raising three kids, you know, and somehow us staying safe and becoming in that environment, you know, there's no way she's not a special person because of how she did it.
How'd you come to choose USD?
It felt right. My grandfather was a big part of my life, my mom's dad. And we did all of my home visits at his house. Now, obviously, they recruited me on the phone. They were great. Randy Bennett and I mean, it was like immediate. Randy Bennett and I were like connected. We're so different and this, that, but just in talking to him and the way he would allow you to be yourself in his presence and still help you. And he was amazing that way. So we connected, and then Coach Egan and I really hit it off, but then Coach Egan hit it off with my grandfather. And I mean, some great coaches came to the house. Carol Williams, Dick Davey came to the house, you know, John Olive and people like that came to the house. You know, you was recruited by a lot of these people and higher. But you're talking about high level coaches, great people. This was when coaches like really had the reputation of who, you know, they had solidified themselves, a lot of these guys. And so it was cool for that, for me to go through that process and have my grandfather and my mother there with me to figure it out. But it was easy, man. I knew going to the visit, I started, my first visit was USD. I didn't take another visit. I knew after the visit.
So you're in the WCC at that time.
Yeah.
Okay. What people need to remember is, okay, this is fresh off LMU, right? And they're, and them going to the Elite Eight and playing a different style, right? Pepperdine has dudes, right? Pepperdine has dudes.
Doug Christie.
Yes.
Dana Jones, who knocked us out of the city championship at North Hollywood, who was a hell of a player. They got dudes. They, Lopez. Oh, my God. I still have bad dreams about them.
I mean, Gonzaga wasn't even a player then. They weren't really.
It was all right. It was good.
Right. Santa Clara got, that was when they first got Nash. And they,
me and all Nash, they came got, in together.
And then what was the other guard who played Major League Baseball they had?
Don Woolery from L.A. who played at the B&B Spurs with me. He was his backcourt mate his first 2 years. Long defensive guard lefty. And then Marlon Garnett, who eventually was the player of the year in the WC, played in the backcourt with him after John graduated, who went to Hamilton High, who now coaches for the Atlanta Hawks, sits behind the bench. And then, obviously, you know who else played there? Lloyd Pierce was at Santa Clara, who was – I remember first time he caught a lob behind me, over me, whatever you want to call it. I was just like somebody put a rocket up his ass. Good grief. But, yeah, they were loaded. They were good.
Yes.
And Dick Davey was the coach. So they were phenomenal.
Right. And but like St. Mary's wasn't, it's so weird like how that whole thing has changed. St. Mary's wasn't very good.
But it came towards the end of my time, St. Mary's became good because that's when they got
the big dude. Yes.
Sufi was the point guard on that team. Yep. They ended up going to the tournament.
Yes. Crazy.
They ended up getting good.
What was, so you get there and people forget like back then, that was before the Slim Jim. You guys had that. You guys played in a bad high school gym. Had a stage on one side.
Oh,
right. Stage on one side stands there. Your Division I program in San Diego. Stage on one side, and so your first year you show up playing for Hank Egan. What was it like?
Brutal. Would not let me sniff the court. I was too flashy, too pig-headed in his eyes. This is how he saw me, and he was probably right. And my argument to him was every time I would win a drill or he would have to kick me out of practice because I was telling somebody I'm kicking your ass was my argument to him was you knew this about me already. So you brought me here.
Why'd you sign me?
That was my attitude, you know, and what I didn't realize what he was trying to do was he was trying to take me somewhere else. He was trying to chip away at things that was probably going to end up hurting me later and try to get me to think outside of that. Now, it wasn't always the most tactful way to do it because I really, you know, just to be really honest about it, I just didn't deal with a white man yelling at me well.
No question.
Because, one, I'm half white and my father left when I was a kid and all I was raised around was black men and I had this bravado and this ego about it that was – you don't get to talk to me like that, or you don't get to tell me what to do. Now, if the same thing happened with my high school coach or a black coach, they can call me a piece of crap and I would just take it. But for whatever reason, that racial issue stood there with me and Hank early on. I couldn't take it. And eventually when the suffering got so much and I said, all right, this is how it's going to be. And I tried to go home and tell my mom I wanted to transfer to UC Irvine with Todd. And Rod Baker and all of those guys, my mom looked at me like I had crap on my face. And she was like, are you crazy? She's like, you think I'm gonna let you quit? She was like, you committed to those people. They didn't say it was gonna be easy. You're staying. And I stuck it out. I went back the next year, my sophomore year. It started off a little bumpy. And lo and behold, by five or six games into the season, I started, and I never looked. It never.
Who's your first start against? Do you remember?
I don't. I think it was in. I know what triggered it. I just don't know the team that it was, but I know it happened. We went to New York for the Seton Hall tournament, and it was us, Seton Hall, Stanford, and Manhattan. And I played my tail off coming off the bench, and it was just got to a point where even the players was telling coach, like, look, man, we got to start this dude. And we want to follow him, you know. And so that ended up being the thing that changed it. And, you know, it was cool, though, because now I look back on that team and I had a bunch of NBA guys playing right there next to me. They didn't play in the league, but they ended up coaching and GMing and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. So, you know, it was fun being a part of that and leading with them. And then Hank left me. Hank goes to the Spurs and he turns into Pop's top assistant. And then I had to start over with Brad Holland. Which was awesome.
Okay. So do you want to know what game it was?
Which one was it?
Okay. So you didn't start the first 10 games of the year.
There you go.
Okay. You didn't start the first 10 games of the year. So let me count it. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 8, 9. Yep. Manhattan. You beat Manhattan by 3.
And that was big.
In Jersey. Yeah. Okay. And then I think it was Drake at home.
That makes played sense. Drake.
Yeah.
That makes
played
sense.
Drake. You lost to Weber State.
Oh, yeah.
Play Drake, and that was your first start.
There it is. And
let me test your memory on this. Do you remember losing to Pepperdine in the tournament championship to go to the NCAA tournament your sophomore year?
Yep. I botched the shot. Not ready to take the big shot. I threw up a brick. We pushed it. It was a three-point game with the ball. They were up three. We had the ball. I was running a high pick and roll with Brooks Barnhart, our pick and pop big. He slipped out, and everybody went with him. And never in the whole time of the timeout, of my timeout on court, did I ever put it in my mind I might have to take this shot. I had my mind made up. I was getting off of it, and I shot it, and it was a brick, and the game was over. And it sticks with me to this day about being present. It's always been a lesson I've kept with me about, you know, look at the moment from here, not from here. And but yeah, it was that one stuck with me for a long time. Cause too, you know, what else was always kind of in my gut was Steve Nash and what he did the year before at Santa Clara. You know, Steve took Santa Clara. He was a big part of them going to the tournament and beating Arizona the year before.
Beat Arizona, right.
And so I'm like, damn, I ain't barely played my freshman year. Here is this guy. I passed on Santa Clara. This guy comes in. He does all of this great stuff. He's like this big-time player. I'm like, I got to match this guy. I got to get there. And sure enough, I'm at the window of it, and it don't happen. And it was just like, oh, my God. I kept replaying. I can't tell you how many times I watched that play. I dreamed that play over and over again.
So Brad comes in.
Yeah.
Completely different dude than – Hank Egan.
Oh, totally different. But, okay. But still the same basketball morals, I would say. The same basketball.
Explain.
Well, it just felt like you don't cheat the game. You don't cheat the game. You don't cheat your teammates. You don't cheat the work. You. It's bigger than you. It was always that attitude of it's bigger than you. Brad.
Okay, but if you think about it now, okay, so look, you had – what you classically call dad issues and being yelled at by an older white dude. Now Brad's much younger, a good looking guy, UCLA, confident, very confident. Right. So, but it's your team. Like, hey man, I'm the point guard, your team. What was that like? Right. So nowadays you would have left. You would have, I'm going to go to SC. I'm going to go to UCLA. I'm a starting point guard. I'm going to go somewhere bigger, or I'm going to go somewhere, you know, I'm going to follow an assistant. See if Randy goes to Pepperdine. I'm going to go there, whatever. Okay. So, but back then, so you guys butt heads. What was it like?
So if you go back to what we talked about before, I had now felt an attachment to Coach Egan.
Yes.
Because we went through that circle.
Right.
And now I finally got to this place with this guy where the mutual respect was there. The ground was laid for our relationship to really bloom and to take off. The walls were down. The understanding was there. And now I had to go through that whole process again, but with a more and had done more and had much, you know, he won an NBA title. Brad Holland was a big part of the Lakers winning a title. Like, he had big games in the finals. And so this, you know, and he had his way and he had, you know, and so it was like, I never took a step back out of it to empathize with his situation. He kept the whole staff, you know, now I'm older and understand what that means to keep a whole staff. He kept Randy, he kept Kyle Smith, who's an awesome coach that we know up in Washington State. You know, Mike Hopp, who's a big time high school coach at St. Augustine in San Diego now. All of those guys stayed on the staff. Brad didn't bring his own guys. He didn't get into any of that stuff. So he just basically threw himself into an environment where it was already set up. And I never gave him the benefit of the doubt early on to, you know, or empathize with his situation at all. All I could think about was me in that situation.
Right.
And how this was going to affect me. And so it was early on. It was a who's right. Right. I'm trying to show him I'm right. He's right. He's trying to put his stamp on the program. So we will argue. It came to a head, and I'll never forget, it was at Gonzaga. And right or wrong, it don't matter, but we ended up running a play out of bounds, play baseline out of bounds to tie the game late to beat them. And they were really good. Sensational. And the play went wrong. And he went off on me about it. And it was just, I was pissed about the play. Everybody was pissed about the play. And it's just the timing of it all. It just ended up, and he grabbed my arm, not in I'm going to hurt you way, but just grabbed me. We was here. It just reminded me so much. And that's why I thought it was easy for me to help D Wade through that time when him and Spo butted heads in the playoffs, because I just remember that thing, that straw that broke the camel's back in that moment. And, we was basically squared up in the locker room after the game. Randy Bennett had to pull us apart. And when it was over, we sat down like normal human beings and we started talking through it. And from that day on, it was just immediate love, like immediate. Like, it was like we had to go all the way to this boiling point.
Yes.
To get to a place where we started to understand each other and love each other.
Well, it's probably, you know, you both are like that. You're kind of wired the same way, where
type A.
Like, not just type A, but you needed somebody to stand up to you, and he needed you to stand up to him in order to respect you. Right.
Yes.
Nobody wants a pushover.
And the other thing too, you got to think about, Doug, like, part of me being that, okay, here's this guy now who established himself as the team leader, the point guard, all of that. And now this new guy's coming in. It's like, I got to, without knowing it, he had to go through this gauntlet of earning all of our respect, right? The staff, the players. And so he came in like, chest out. I'm Brad Holland. I'm this guy. You should respect me because I just won at Fullerton. And, you know, I played in the league and UCLA. And he had all of that. And he's right. He had a freaking resume, you know. And so here I am trying to be that guy that stands up for the team almost. And so, like, and it was just all the wrong way of going about it. But you learn, you know, you learn. And then it just ended up, you just don't know how it goes in your life. The same guy who I was face-to-face with in the locker room, nose-to-nose, hired me back from the Miami Heat when I was an intern with Spo, brought me back to USD to be a coach on his staff, and jump-started my coaching career. And so you just don't know in these moments who's going to do what later on in your life. But if you can eventually just kind of see it for what it is and really realize, you know, love people for who they are and just end up building good relationships, stuff happens along the way that, you know, you end up in a great place.
Okay, so you lose your last game to Portland. Last game you're...
Yep. Deion Holton. He was the He haunted my dreams. A little pit bull from Long Beach. I'll never forget it. It was brutal. We sat in the locker room for a long time. Mike Brown sat in the locker room with me for a long time. He was there scouting. And this is before he took off. He was just getting into the NBA. He was a, you know, had interned with Bernie in Denver and had started scouting for Washington. And he sat back there with me and we talked and he, you know, basically scooped me up off the ground. Cause you know, you went through it that last game and you don't know, especially if you don't know if you're going to get to that next place. You know, like for me, it was
even if you do, it's not the same.
It don't matter, right?
There's this speech that Bo Schembechler gave one time before the Ohio State game to Michigan, and he said it's all about the team. He said you'll never be a part of another team. And I want to get to this in a second with you with the championship teams you're a part of, but he said, you know, when you go professional, you're playing for your family, you're playing for a contract, you're playing for yourself. This is your last chance to be a part of a team. And I'm sure there's some family, and how LeBron did it, made it as close to the collegiate feel as you could, but you're still going home to your wife and your kids. And it's still not the same. Whereas these people you lived around, you grew up around, you earn their respect. They earn your respect. You know, that's your family. And that's why they hired you back. Right. Cause your family.
Yeah.
I just remember sitting in a locker room in Syracuse, New York. We lost in Elite Eight. And I was looking at Joe Atkins, who's from Oklahoma City, and, you know, and Joe and I, you know, he hated me when I first got there because he thought like I came in to play point, and he thought he was a point guard, and we played together for 3 years.
Ended up loving you.
We had an absolute like, I mean, I threw him into the chair. We had a, like an absolute fight like the first week of practice.
After that, we were boys.
You're boys. And, you know, like if he was in trouble right now, I would get on a plane and fly wherever he was and help him out. Right. But I just remember looking around the locker room like, man, I love these dudes. I do not want to leave this place.
Right.
And it's just such a devastating feeling.
You're
in that place. What happened next?
So I still had two classes left. And the school weren't letting me off the hook. And so they said, we're going to pay for it. You stay on and coach with the staff. You know, Coach Holland is going to let you do volunteer work. So I ended up working with the coaching staff that for a semester. And all of that time, I'm practicing with the team as a coach because I'm trying to get in shape to go play. I'm thinking – I want to still play. You know, I was just all conference and I was top 10 in assists in the country. And I'm thinking, okay, I think I got a chance to at least make some money at it. I wasn't ready to go into anything else. And I ultimately had to stop coaching with the team because I wasn't in class anymore. I got my degree. And now the second semester of the year, I'm literally working. And I still look back on this as probably one of the most fondest points of my life is I'm living in a shack across the street from the college in this area called the Dog Patch. It's like this little one and a half, one bath, nothing. I mean, me and my boy Tom was paying like $500 a month total to live in this place.
I'm who?
This guy that just was a student at USD. He was just this cool cat that I became friends with, like Jazz, you know, white cat, cool as hell. So, but he was responsible. I knew he was going to have his $250 every month, you know, the whole thing. So I'm living in this place. I'm working at the airport for UPS, loading and unloading UPS cargo packages out of the planes. So I would get there at 4:30. I would ride my bike to the airport. I didn't have a car. I got a degree. I don't have a car. I ride my bike to the airport 4:30 in the morning for conditioning, which was like an hour ride. I get there. They always threw me in the plane because I was the biggest dude there. It would be 18 or so cargo holders, which is like the exact same shape of the inside of the plane, but it holds 1,800 pounds of packages. And I would pull them off, slide them onto this thing. They take them on, put them on the trucks, send them on their way. Go home after 3 or 4 hours of that, making a little over minimum wage. eat, take a nap, wake up, go to the school, lift, work on my game, play pickup, go back to the airport for the evening and take the packages off the truck, put them onto the plane for to go out that evening. And that was my job. And I did that for about 6 months, and I got a deal to go to play in Paris or in France, Division II. And right when I'm about to leave, two of my boys got sent home from France. These dudes could flat out score the ball. I mean, like, I couldn't score. Like, that just was not my forte. I couldn't score. We could pass the hell out of it. We could guard. Yeah. We could run the team. Couldn't score. So I'm like, oh, my God, am I really about to go over here for like 2 weeks, 3 weeks? They realize I can't score. Then I'm coming right back home. And out of nowhere, my phone rings. Mike Brown calls me. He says, I don't know what you got going on. He goes, but I got a buddy that's the video coordinator in Miami. He just lost his intern. If you want to get into coaching, do it kind of how I've gone about it, you know, go through the video room and move into NBA coaching. He's like, this will be a great opportunity to do it. He said, you can go back and play after this if you don't like it. He was like, but you might want to take a look at this. I said, well, I'll talk to the guy. I get on the phone with what now we know is Eric Spoelstra as a young 25-year-old in the video room. He hits me up. We're chatting it up, and I sit down and kind of go through the – take my ego out of it. And I said, you know, I can just do this right now and put by, you know, I can come back and hoop. Lo and behold, I go to Miami and the rest is history. I ended up bagging hooping and I just went on the coaching route.
So, okay. So you show up Miami, Spo's in the video room. Okay. Who else is on the staff?
The staff that year was Stan Van Gundy was the top assistant, who I love deeply and dearly. Bob McAdoo, who was on the staff even with me for a long time, who was just like a blood brother to me, and Jeff Bezdelic, who I love to death, who's an incredible coach that we know. Yes. People that's in basketball circles know that Jeff Bezdelic is one of the best minds. And Tony Fiorentino, who ended up doing TV after that.
TV, before. Right? Yeah.
Yep. And that was really it because staffs were small. Keith Askins was on the team. Tim Hardaway Sr., Zoe, Dan Marley, PJ Brown, Ike Austin, Vashawn Leonard. I know I'm forgetting somebody. Mark Strickland.
Okay, I need validation. A couple stories, Miami stories. Okay. Then these are ones that are okay being broadcast, right? So I'm with the Lakers in summer league, or maybe I would go there. I did like three different stints in like vet mini camp. I was in their summer league 1 year. Mm-hmm. I'll never forget that Ike was like, "Yo, young buck, whatever you do, don't go to Miami." I was like, "Why?" Man, he's like, "You get to training camp, they take care of you, but you can't leave the gym." I was like, "What are you talking about?" He's like, Pat sets up shop and you don't leave the gym. You go like three a day. He's like, best shape of my life, took years off my career. That's what he said. Took years off my career because we went so hard in that training camp. True or false?
A lot of truth. I don't agree with Austin that it took years off his career. I think he saved his career because he weighed about 350.
Yes.
And Pat and them, that's when weight and body fat became a real thing, you know. Yes. Conditioning tests and all of that stuff. And so, yeah, three a day was probably something Pat would do every now and then because he's crazy like that. But I also think that it's a part of why we recognize Ike Austin as the player that he was, too, is because Pat got all that weight off of him.
Yeah.
And got him to a peak conditioning level where he could really highlight his talent. You know, but yeah, Pat was not messing around.
What was that? Okay. Like, okay.
Oh, by the way, I wasn't allowed in the gym. So, you know.
So, okay. So what was, do you remember the first time? Remember, you're from LA.
Yeah.
80s LA.
Yeah.
Magic was the biggest thing on earth. And Pat Riley was probably the second biggest thing.
They were just planets. They were their own planets, right?
Okay. So like you show up, and you're a video dude for Pat Riley. Now, here's the other story. Okay. So Buzz told me, he's like, you want to know what the NBA is like? I was like, yeah, tell me. This is back when he was at Air Force, I think.
Right.
He told me a story. He said he remembered being on the team plane doing the advanced scout. And I think Jeff was on the staff, or maybe Stan was on the staff, whatever. He can't remember who else was. And he said, I looked up from watching some video and taking notes, writing stuff down. And I said, who did we play tonight? And he's like, they were like, you know, we played Charlotte. Did we win? Yeah. Who do we play tomorrow? They're like, we play the Nets. Are they? He's like, all right, what day is it? He's like, he didn't know who they played or what day it was. He just knew he had the Nets scout and it better be right. And that was all that mattered. That was it. That was his entire world.
It was. It was.
So what's it like as a video guy?
And he was the best at it.
Okay, but what's it like as a video guy? Because you can't screw it up. Because if you screw it up, then he screws it up.
So let me give you. So let me give you a great screw up. My one and only screw up for my idol Pat Riley. So here it is. This young kid from LA, just like you. All the championships, all the parades, the showtime is everything.
Do you think people have a healthy respect for how big that was? Right? Like because of the Last Dance documentary, the Jordan era, I think people start to understand how big it was. I would tell you that while Magic now may not be as big as Jordan, obviously, but Magic and Bird were the league. And Pat Riley was the coach of the league. Like he was Showtime.
It was electricity. It was the only place you could watch a game. This is how I describe the Lakers. The Lakers looked like they played outside.
That's a good one. That's good. I like that.
Go back and look at the Forum and how it lit up and the electricity in the building and the beautiful people and all the shiny. And it was just like they were hooping at Venice Beach. It was like the wind was blowing through the Forum. That's what it reminded me of. It was perfection. It was basketball beauty at its finest. And you had this unbelievably charismatic winner that held the ball and the guy that was leading them. And it was just this perfect, it couldn't have came together better, right? It couldn't have asked for the perfect formulation of two people with Pat and Magic and their personalities and their persona and what they stood for and how they wanted to play. And just, it was beautiful to grow up in that. And I deeply believe this. I believe you do what you do and I do what I do. And all of our crew of that group had a lot of it has to do with what we witnessed from UCLA growing up as kids and understanding about John Wooden and ultimately what it stood for to be a winner and the Lakers. They put something in all of us as hoopers where we didn't just settle for being like, no, we got to win. We had to win. It wasn't like just being a good hooper. Like we was going after each other every time we played. It was always about pushing each other. It was always about trying to achieve this incredible level. And so, you know, now here it is. I get moved into Miami. I'm an intern. And I'm in the video room, and my job is to put videotapes in all of these VCRs and record the games. All of these copies, Stan's copy, Pat's copy, Bob McAdoo. It says it on the, I make the labels to put on the VHS, and I put them in, and I hit the remote, and boom, we record the game, the live feed. Game's over. I get the guys they tape. Me and supposed to, you know, we're in the video room grinding. We would never leave before midnight. And, Spo's phone rings. This is I think Spo had just gotten his first cell phone. None of us had cell phones. And I hear, and Spo's face drops. And he turns and he looks at me and he goes, dude, we're in big trouble. And I'm like, what? He's like, that was Pat. And I'm like, what happened? He's like, you sent Pat home with a blank tape. I can't even tell you how far this all fell out of my butt. Like, it was like everything dropped out of my butt. Like, and I just was like, oh my God. Like, first off, Pat did not even talk to me other than What's up, kid? You got that tape? That was like the extent of our dialogue that year was a couple of those. Hey, where's Spo at? Hey, make sure he gets me these tapes. So this is Pat Riley, who I'm still like, he hasn't spoken to me in a way that makes me feel at ease. I've given him a blank tape. I have to take the tape, the new tape, and drive it to his house in the Gables. And Spo tells me, hey, put it in his mailbox. He'll come out and, you know, he'll come get it. Right when I'm about to put it in the mailbox, the big gate opens and he comes walking out.
What'd he say?
Takes the tape from me, puts his hand on my shoulder. He goes, David, it's okay. Mistakes happen. If you ever do it again, pack your shit. Turns and walks back into his big old corner lot to stay in the Gables. I jump back in Spo's little red Subaru station wagon and I speed back to the video room and Spo's like,
still no car?
No car. I can't afford a car. I couldn't afford it. The one I had broke down in Cali. I had an 83 Regal and it held on until it couldn't. And then what was I going to do? Drive that from Cali to Miami? It was like, what can I do? I got around on the Metro. Spo drove me around. I rode bikes. I figured it out. And that, I made $600 a month. I made $600 a month. And I lived with a good friend of ours who gave me a room for just the cost of utilities. Thank God. And I had a little bitty room and I made it work. I just made it work. And you know what else saved my life? The Heat had a card that they got from Hooters that gave you like 50, 60% off of everything. So I lived at Hooters basically. None of the girls liked me because I was broke and I was always pulling out this half off card, but I got to eat a lot of different stuff on the Hooters menu. So that was like my nutrition for that year. And Spo was right next to me because he was broke and the car he was driving was holding on for for dear life.
How'd you get elevated when that happened?
Say that again, Doug.
When did you get elevated?
So I had a chance to stay with the Heat that year. And I just knew I didn't want to do video no more. I just was like, I learned a ton. Like, I couldn't even tell you. It was like going to college, the education I got in one season. And then the relationship I built with the guy I was sitting next to every day. It was incredible. But I just knew, like, immediately at the end of that year, I was like, God, I want to get back onto the basketball floor. I want to get back on. Because it was different then. Like, I didn't even go on the floor with Stan Van Gundy. When he would work out guys to rebound, Spo was the rebounder for him. They kept it tight and they still keep it tight. They don't let you in, just anybody come in the gym. And so I never got to even, you know, exhaust that part of just wanting to be out on the court during that year. And so I was like, I got to get back on the court. And Brad called. Randy went to St. Mary's, I want to say, is what happened. I think that year, once somebody left the staff, and then the third assistant opened up, and I went back to San Diego, and I moved up every year. We had a good staff, and every year somebody left, I moved up. And the last year I was up at the top assistant, Fresno State called and offered me a job there. And I felt like it was the right time to get out of my comfort zone and really recruit a whole different player. Because USD, you was pigeonholed into, the kid had to be like a straight-A student, like, right. You know, SAT, ACT, top scores, all of this stuff. Where at Fresno, you just had to have a pulse. So it was like, you know, I jumped into a whole different pool of kids, JC kids, kids that had hard, you know, upbringing, like, you know, kids that I could – actually grew up
related.
Yeah, that was much more who I was on a cultural level, on a how I grew up level, like all of that stuff. So that year was also really good for me from a growth standpoint, because I worked with Ray Lopes, who was Kelvin Sampson's protege, but Bob Burton, who I know you know of, was, you know,
great junior college coach.
Oh, great, great junior college coach, Cal State Fullerton, the whole deal. And then Andy Newman, who ended up being his assistant, is a really close friend of mine who's out here in Cal. Pomona Pitzer. He's at one of these schools out here. I always damn forget. He's going to kill me. San Bernardino. That's where I think he's at. And they were just such unbelievable coaches. And so that progression ended up leading me there. And then just out of nowhere, a USD alum hit me looking for a player development guy, Eric Musselman, who we all know very well now after what he just did this year, called me up and said, Fizz, you know, I know we don't know each other well, but we brothers and alums, we Toreros, and I want you to come up and interview for my player development job.
Think about that for a second, though, okay? Think about this for a second. USD, who the only year USD made the tournament was when my boy Jason Keep was there, right?
Who I helped recruit. Jason Keep to come there. Right.
And Keep, by the way, he's doing tattoos. I don't know where he's doing tattoos.
Arizona, I think. I think he's in Phoenix was the last place I saw him.
The craziest shit is this. This dude is doing tattoos on other people. And he showed up on campus at Oklahoma State with the worst tattoo in the history of tattoos. Right? So here's the story. And he's going to have me on another pod. So it is summer, is this time of year. It's like just before May, probably April of maybe first week in May. And there's a weekend where we bring in recruits because it's the Delta Dunk, because a fraternity has a 5-on-5 tournament on dunk ball hoops. Right. And it's fun. Now we don't get to play in it, and then sororities have like a beach volleyball tournament and we played in that. So coach comes in, maybe it was one of the assistants came in, and they like have like a one sheet on the player who's coming in, and hey man, like you're gonna host him and you guys all take him out. So like, hey, we got a big dude coming in this week from College of Northern Idaho. Now coach had a long time ago been at College of Southern Idaho. We're like, Northern Idaho, like up there. A polar bear, right? Like, no, this dude he's 6'11", he's 265, 270 pounds, he's jacked, he worked on an oil rig. We're like, oh, all right, I'm kind of in here. Like, I want to see this guy. So this dude comes in, shaved head, looks like America History X, right? Yep. And we're like, hey, we're going to go play in this volleyball tournament. Like, you want to come? He's like, come, I want to play. Like, all right. So we start drinking. And I mean, it's out in the sun. There's girls. We all take off our shirts. So dude takes off his shirt. And he's big and pretty jacked. And I was like, yo, what's that on your arm? He's like, it's my signature. I was like, bro, you're missing a D. It said Big Daddy, right? D-A-D-Y was the tattoo. Like, yo, what? Did you run out of money? Did you not pay the guys? No. I wanted it that way. So we will get to the bottom of the story. Because when he got to USD, I know he got it covered up with some other thing that looked terrible. But he had the Big Daddy tattoo. And here's the other connector to it. So my favorite Jason Keefe story of all time is he was like, he came from a tough upbringing, obviously.
Yeah.
And like immediately we were like family, to where he divulged way too many of his personal secrets and demons to us, but it was cool. Cause you're in a small town like Stillwater. It's like,
but he has some demons. Yeah.
So we're playing Vegas for a second straight year. We play on the road in Vegas and we're trailing at the halftime. And I think they still had Kaspers Kambala, whatever. But they're not very good. This is after the year after Sean Marion left. And our big guys are just playing scared. So I'm walking in the locker room, and I tell the coach, like, I got him, coach. He's like, all right, you got 10 minutes. So I go in there, and I'm just motherfucking him up and down, all our big guys. Like, you bunch of, it's on national TV. It's embarrassing, whatever. And I'm yelling at Ryan Montanati, who's our starting four, and Fred Yancey, who's our starting five, and Alex Weber, who's our backup five. And I'm not yelling at Jason because Jason didn't play in the first half. Right? This is like his fifth college game or something, right? And he goes, hey, you yell at the big guys, you yell at me too, together. And everybody just cut up laughing. We're like, yo, you didn't even fucking play. What are you talking about, right? And he was a trip. But that was the only time USD goes to the tournament. And he's the only guy, I think Brad didn't get to graduate. Brad was there forever.
Yeah,
everybody graduated. It's really impressive, except for Davey. But think about it. USD that had a high school gym, produces you, Brownie, and Muss, like three NBA head coaches. That's obscene. That's crazy. That's crazy when you think about it.
I'm not done. James Borrego.
Yes.
Is ours.
That's four.
We've had, now I don't even want to keep going, but Chris Grant was a general manager.
Right.
Played with me at USD. Yeah. Bernie Bickerstaff.
And Hawks, what?
Bernie Bickerstaff played and graduated and coached. He's the pipeline. That's what people don't realize. Bernie is one of the first. He played at USD. That's my connection to JB Bickerstaff and the family, and Mike Brown's path to the league was through Bernie. So Bernie was the first of us to get in. When Mike graduated, he wanted to get in the league. Bernie gave him an internship in the video room. And then Neil Meyer and Chris Grant came after that. And then all of a sudden, it was just a flood of us. And Muss really was separate from Bernie in his path because
of his dad. Yeah.
And so, you know, but it's just what you're saying is incredibly right, because it's a special place, because you just, for a school that didn't produce pro basketball players, for a place that didn't embrace basketball in a way, obviously through the facilities and you know, this wasn't a big time program. For a place to be like that in this little place and down in San Diego to produce that many basketball people is amazing. We always laugh about it. We try to help the next guy up. You know, Steve Kerr's kid is one of us.
Yep.
There, Nick. And, you know, we got a bunch. It's a lot of us now who have made the jump.
Wow, that was great stuff for part one. All right, so listen, we'll drop part two tomorrow, the following day, or whatever. I think you'll really, really enjoy it. In the meantime, remember, the Doug Gottlieb Show is daily, right? 3 to 6 Eastern, 12-3 Pacific on Fox Sports Radio, the iHeartRadio app, or wherever you download podcasts. You can also download that podcast as well. In the meantime, tell a friend about this. Download, subscribe, rate, and write a review too. Why wouldn't you? And if you think this part of the pod was good, wait till you hear the next couple parts. It's amazing. My thanks to David Fizdale. I'm Doug Gottlieb, and this is All Ball.